Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio, and Sidney Blumenthal is with us. We're watching this bizarre spectacle, and I think yesterday when George Voinovich, and we'll get into this in more detail in our second hour, when Jed Babin, who used to work for George Herbert Walker Bush, comes on to tell us about the wonders of the Republican Party. But George Voinovich comes out, the Republican from Ohio, comes out and says, hey, wait a minute, aren't we hemorrhaging money here? Aren't we killing ourselves? Aren't we bleeding ourselves? He sort of sounded like an Eisenhower Republican, which I think is a dying breed. Sidney Blumenthal, he has a new book out. He's the author, first of all, of a number of books, Rise of the Counter-Establishment, The Conservative Ascent to Political Power, and The Pledge Alliance, Last Campaign of the Cold War, regular contributor to opendemocracy.net, as well as his regular column for the UK newspaper The Guardian. But his new book, The Strange Death of Republican America, Chronicles of a Collapsing Party. Sidney Blumenthal, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
This is fascinating. This is absolutely fascinating. It's sort of the reverse of, you know, the coming wave of Republicanism. You know, Kevin Phillips' book from, what was it, 1968, 72, something like that, The Coming Republican Majority?
Well, Kevin Phillips was the strategist for Richard Nixon in the 68 campaign, and his book was called The Emerging Republican Majority.
Okay.
And that was really when the Republicans put it together. The Democrats collapsed, and the Republicans had been the dominant political force. But we're coming to the end of that. The other book that you cited of mine, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, just out in paperback now, which I wrote 25 years ago. I've written a new introduction. I call it From Dick Cheney to Dick Cheney. But that's the rise. We're
right
now in the stage where the Republicans under George W. Bush have repudiated traditional Republicanism. They've imploded as a result of Bush's radicalism. There's been a chain reaction of self-generated catastrophe. And in 2006, the Republican Congress was repudiated. I think it's going to be a long time before we see another Republican Congress.
Well, I found your book fascinating. I'd like to stick with the first half of it for just a minute, if we can. You point out the modern Republican rise was first apparent in the midterm elections of 66, and you say in the wake of early frustrations over Vietnam, racial turmoil over the passage of the civil rights legislation. Isn't it really the latter? I mean, you go on to say this is Nixon's strategy to bring in Southern Democrats and ethnic suburban white flight Catholics, and that Spiro Agnew referred to this strategy as amnesty, acid, and abortion.
Yeah, that was the beginning of what we have come to call the culture war, which
right
was waged throughout the 1990s and culminated in the impeachment trial of President Clinton.
Well, but it even goes farther. I mean, a little earlier on page 106, 107, mm-hmm, you talk about Bob Woodward, and you get into how Woodward had just absolutely sucked up to Bush, and, you know, he confused his interviews with access to truth and perhaps even intimacy, his book Bush at War, and then later in a state of denial, now the Bush administration feels betrayed by him, but that he really missed the real stuff, you know, the real essential stuff, like the relationships between the House of Saud and the House of Bush.
I get whiplash reading the collected works of Bob Woodward.
Me too. And I don't understand why anybody else doesn't. It's not something that is typically talked about on the talk show circuit. And he's certainly, you know, I've never seen anybody confront him about it.
Yeah. You know, I worked with Bob. I was a staff writer at the Washington Post. I covered the Reagan White House, actually. So I saw Republicanism at its high tide. And Bob's first book on Bush, Bush at War, it was absolutely essential for the Bush administration in establishing a false image of Bush as brave, resolute, decisive, in control, the president who was in charge, that Cheney was just a secondary figure, and so on. It couldn't have been paid for by the Bush administration. It was the image that the Bush people used all the way through the campaign of 2004. Then you
right
get to
in fact, you point out in your book that this is the image that they even for themselves couldn't create. They had to have Bob Woodward to do it for them.
Far better to outsource this
yeah
to somebody who had his own independent credibility that's much greater than your own. That's that's ideal. You know, it's what Bush at one point called slinging the propaganda. That's actually a phrase that he used. But now we're at the, you know, Bush is now at a low ebb. He has the lowest popularity of, you know, any recent president. Republicanism is a discredited creed if you can define republicanism.
Right, but this is just a short 5 years later. I mean, you have this arc from 66 to 2002 of progressively increasing positive fortunes and aggregation of power and wealth among the Republican Party to the point where, you know, an icon like Bob Woodward is sucking up to George W. Bush and helping him cheerlead for his war. And here now in this short 5 years, this entire house of cards has come apart.
Well, you know, sort of you can chart the quick rise and fall of George W. Bush by just charting the degree to which Bob Woodward is favorable or unfavorable to him. He's one of what Rumsfeld would have called the metrics.
Yeah, one of the weather vanes. Well, and you also talk about Gonzalez in this book and how, as we go along in the book, I'm on page 208 here, and you're writing about how Bush is protecting Alberto Gonzalez in order to protect those who gave Gonzalez his marching orders. And this is the key that, again, never gets discussed in the media about what's going on with regard to, for example, Gonzalez and Harriet Myers refusing to answer the subpoena. If the tables were turned and the Democrats were being charged with these kind of things and the Republicans were in control, the Republicans would be screaming, okay, which Republicans were you wiretapping? And which, they would have completely turned this around, but really the reason Bush is protecting Gonzalez is because Gonzalez is protecting Bush and Rove.
There's no question about it. Gonzalez, who Bush had nicknamed Fredo after the weak brother in The Godfather, has been protecting Bush since Bush was a governor and Gonzalez was his private lawyer then, and then later his counsel. He's done this consistently. We've seen the purge of the U.S. attorneys for political purposes, perfectly competent people who wouldn't pursue Karl Rove's agenda in going after Democrats. What is consistent in the whole U.S. attorney scandal is that the people who were purged did not go after Democrats on bogus charges, and it's the complete politicization across the board of the Justice Department. We've never had this before.
Right, and I wonder if the Siegelman thing is the unraveling of that. You know, later in the book you talk about how Michael Gerson is sort of playing the role for Rove that in the early days Woodward was playing for Bush.
Well, Gerson has become a kind of romantic image maker for Karl Rove and defending him. Yet, you know, what if you remember just last year, one of the speechwriters who worked with Michael Gerson, who was the chief speechwriter for Bush, one of those who put in the more high-flown and purple prose elements to all of his speeches, talked about how Gerson took credit for other people's works and was something of a fraud himself. And you find this kind of exposure and revelation sort of consistent through all the layers of the Bush administration.
We're talking with Sidney Blumenthal, author of The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and his new book, The Strange Death of Republican America, Chronicles of a Collapsing Party. What is the main carry-home message that of the book in your mind, sir?
The main message of this book is that the Republican Party became the dominant influence over public policy and politics in our country after the Democratic debacle of 68. And now the Republicans have imploded. Their fall came from their own arrogance, their own radicalism, pushing beyond the edge of the envelope in a very short period of time under Bush. And we are really between eras right now. We're not in a new era. There is a great opportunity here for the Democrats, if they'll seize it properly, and then they have to govern well, that could put an end to this whole Republican era that has existed for two generations. And what my book describes is that it provides a framework for understanding that and describes the period in which Bush destroyed traditional republicanism and the Republican effort to create a realignment and a dream of grandeur for power. and how it's fallen.
And how it's fallen. And a good thing for America, frankly. Yes. Sidney Blumenthal, his new book, and it is excellent. The Strange Death of Republican America, Chronicles of a Collapsing Party. Mr. Blumenthal, thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you,
today.
Tom.
Good
My
talking
pleasure.
To you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Carl Rove's mind, all is well.
You know,
I'd really like to sit these guys down sometime and ask them, why should you not be prosecuted for war crimes? I mean, just, you know, why should they not be prosecuted for war crimes? I don't get it. It's our piggies alert.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white sheds? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dead. Always have clean sheds to play around.
Well, the Government Accountability Office is the group in the administration that is supposed to prevent abuse and increase efficiency. So what happens when you turn it over to 20 years, more or less, 20, 30, almost 30 years of Republican rule? Well, the GAO tracked down a whole bunch of interesting things here happening throughout the not the GAO, but tracked down a whole bunch of things that happened throughout the government. The GAO found agencies could not account for nearly $2 million worth of items identified in the audit, including laptop computers, digital cameras, and the Army, more than a dozen computer servers worth $100,000 each. In another case, at the State Department, a cardholder spent money at the Seduction Boutique in Ecuador to buy, now get this, women's lingerie for use during jungle training by trainees of the Drug Enforcement Program. Yeah. Another one, a postmaster used his card to charge $1,100 over a 15-month period for various online dating services. And it goes on and on. Strange stuff, but the perhaps larger piggy alert is that the Food and Drug Administration has tripled now. It's reported today by Elizabeth Weiss and Julie Schmidt in USA Today, has tripled the estimated number of people who may have died of allergic reactions to heparin, a blood thinner, now stands at 62. This is real heparin is made from pig's guts in China, and the Chinese figured out that there's this shellfish component. It's like chondroitin. It's one of these things that's supposed to be good for your joints. That if you modify the molecule just slightly, all the tests tell you that it is actually heparin, when in fact it doesn't work like heparin, but it's cheap. And so they sold it to us as heparin and people died. So therefore, all the more the disaster. It is, speaking of the implosion of Republicanism, and the hearings yesterday, I thought that there were a couple of moments that were really quite extraordinary, and we're going to get into this in some more detail in the second hour. I want to get into some of the economic issues here going on as well in this hour, but George Voinovich yesterday, let me just back up just a little bit. Osama bin Laden, the collected writings of Osama bin Laden were one of my BuzzFlash books of the month a few months back. You go to BuzzFlash.com every month, I've got a book of the month. This month, actually, it's a DVD. It's Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. But one of them was the collected writings of Osama bin Laden. And bin Laden was fairly clear that he just had a couple of simple goals, as it were. Number one, to get U.S. forces out of Saudi Arabia. Well, George Bush did that last year. He took U.S. forces out of Saudi Arabia. Number two, to drive the price of oil up over $100 a barrel because the blood, the wealth of his nation, of the sacred land of Saudi Arabia was being sold cheaply. and oil is now over $100 a barrel. And that number three, he wanted to get the United States involved in a conflict in the Middle East that would bleed us dry just like he did the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And sure enough, here we are, as the Republican from Ohio pointed out yesterday.
We're really at a point right now where we're really strained and stressed out. In addition to that, we have a national debt that's $9 trillion. This budget's going to be out of balance by another $660 billion. And I hate to agree with Senator Feingold, but I think that if Osama bin Laden is sitting back right now looking at this thing, in effect, we're kind of bankrupting this country. We are doing, we're eating our seed corn. We've got some really big problems today.
Yeah, there's no kinda about it, Senator Voinovich. We are bankrupting this country. Well, actually, the Bush administration is bankrupting this country. The Republican Congress is bankrupting this country, and the few Democrats who went along with it.
Hey, and we're in a recession, and God only knows how long we're going to be in it. What we think we need to have is a surge of diplomacy during this period of time.
What a novel idea, a surge of diplomacy. Yeah.
The witnesses that were in last week tell us said that we should take advantage of this 10-month period between this administration going out and the next one coming in. And if we don't do it in terms of diplomacy, if we don't sit down with the Syrians and the Saudis and the Egyptians and tell them, hey, guys, we're on our way out. We have to leave here because of our own financial situation, and we're stressed out to the point where we've got to do this. Now, understand this. And it's not in your best interest to see the thing blow up. It's time for you to step in and start taking some action and bringing people together.
So here we have the Republican George Voinovich of Ohio saying Bin Laden won. He got what he wanted. Because George W. Bush organized it in such a way that he would get what he wanted every step along the way. And you could add, although Bin Laden in the collected writings of Osama Bin Laden did not say, that he would like to stay alive, you know, him and his dialysis machine and his donkey and whatnot in Afghanistan. But he's still alive. He's still running around loose. He's, you know, life is good and he's just fine. So, totally strange.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. You can find out more about that over at Teamster.org. Our phone number, 866-303-2270, toll-free all across the United States. Our website, TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. Over at TomHartman.com, links to our live chat room. Free drop-in, say hi. And, of course, our message boards and all kinds of cool stuff. Philip in Boca Raton, Florida, listening on 940 AM. Hey, Philip, what's up?
Let me give you a solution to the energy problem, if I may.
Sure. Okay.
First of all, I don't think you can impose a standard artificially on people. However, you can, as far as mileage is concerned. However, you can induce it through a tax system, which I call an inverse gas guzzler. Suppose you set a standard. If your car achieves greater than the standard, every year you get a tax credit. If your car achieves less than the standard, every year you pay a tax surcharge. Now, I'm not telling anybody what car to buy. If you got a lot of money, fine, pay the tax. But if not, what will happen is the forces of the marketplace, through the tax credit, will force the manufacturers to design more and more and more efficient cars.
Yeah, I've heard a similar proposal at state levels based on the based on your annual vehicle fee when you get your tags, that the price of your tags would be inversely proportional to your
But this is a federal tax credit. Now, the reason you can do that is because your balance of trade will drop. Since we import so much oil, we have to finance it through debt. And if we have less debt, then there's less interest charges. So we can actually pay for the tax credit that way.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's a very interesting point. Philip, thanks.
Yeah.
thanks a lot for sharing that with us. That's You know, I hadn't considered the part about how it would change the relationship with oil. Elaine in Los Angeles, listening on Gay Talk. Hey, Elaine.
Hey, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Yesterday, when our president gave the family this medal because another young person lost their life in this war, over 4,000 have died. When are we going to
over 4,000 Americans?
Yeah, right. And over 100,000 Iraqis. When are we going to bring him and Cheney and Gonzalez and Rumsfeld up on war charges? Those were not tears of sadness. Those were tears of shame when I saw him.
I would like to hope that that's the case, Elaine, but I don't think that George W. Bush is capable of experiencing shame. I really and truly, and I'm not being hyperbolic here, I'm not exaggerating, and I'm not saying this for effect. I really and I realize the danger of, you know, playing amateur shrink, and I'm low on the food chain. I was only rostered as a psychotherapist in the state of Vermont. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I am convinced that the man is a sociopath. That he views other people as objects, as just, you know, toys in the game of his life, and that he thinks that he's the only real person in the world and the only one who actually feels real emotions.
I know, and this, you know, but the sadness is how many more young men and women? I mean, this has to end.
Yeah, I agree. And where it needs to end, I think, is with some serious consideration for international prosecution. Elaine, thank you for the call. Ellen Ratner's brother, Michael Ratner, is the founder of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. The website used to be ccr-ny.org. I think they have a new one, but it's he's the guy who went to France and to Germany and tried to get Rumsfeld arrested a couple of times. I mean, there's some good people out there doing good work on this. Tom in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I want to salute you, first of all, for your trip to Darfur. I thought that was just really something.
Well, thank you.
Couldn't believe it.
Everybody needs to know about what's going on there and how horrible it is and the relationship between China and what's going on in Darfur and the United States and what's going on in Darfur and global warming, frankly, and what's going on in Darfur as desertification
Absolutely.
Is moving south across northern Africa and just the horrors of it. And there is, if you go to TomHartmann.com and you click on Tom's blog, you scroll down a little bit, and there's a whole bunch of pictures from when we were there, and there's a link to some groups that are doing something about it.
I will definitely check that out. I wanted to agree with the last caller. I just think we just need to just keep voicing our opinions louder and louder and louder until someone listens.
Yeah.
There should not be a statute of limitations on these war crimes.
No, and this is
after Milosevic still, or if he's dead, I don't know, but they're still going after them.
Yeah, and they're still looking for Radovan Karadžić.
That's the one.
Yeah, he's the real architect of the war crimes. He was the psychiatrist who came up with the idea of the rape camps to destroy the local culture.
Absolutely.
And he's still running around loose. Yes, and here's the concern that I have, and this is the precedent that was established with Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, is that Gerald Ford established this precedent of, oh, well, you know, we're just going to let the former president get away with whatever he was able to get away with. And by Jerry Ford pardoning Nixon in all ways, and pardoning most of the members of the Nixon administration ultimately, and then Reagan pardoning
did the same thing.
Yeah, he pardoning all these guys who were actually, a lot of them, you know, from the Nixon administration or buddies of the Nixon administration, but they came along with him, Caspar Weinberger and company. He pardons them, and then George Herbert Walker. Right. Then George Herbert Walker Bush stops the investigation into Iran-Contra, because, of course, it would have led right back to him and his former CIA director, you know, cutting the deal to keep the hostages in Iran, the October surprise.
And treasonous.
I mean, and then Bill Clinton stops the investigation into Iran-Contra. I mean, every step along the way.
I don't understand it.
Neither do I. I do. What it is every president knows that there is something that they can be nailed for. I mean, nobody is completely clean. I mean,
right.
Who would have thought that the thing that would have brought down Bill Clinton would have been something as, you know, in retrospect, relatively innocuous as consensual sex among two adults that wasn't even arguably fully sex. And
it wasn't
yet that
anyone's business.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing that they used to bring. So every president knows that there is something that somebody can track down and nail them to the wall with.
That's
and
right.
So they've all been going along with this idea. Well, we'll just pardon everybody and everything will be fine. And if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton are the next president of the United States, I hope that when they come into office, they are going to say, we need to continue the investigations. We need to hold these people accountable. We need to be moving forward on these things. And we're not going to close the door on this. Tom, spot on. You said it very well, and I appreciate that. Bob in Orange County, California. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
How are you? You have a great show, I wanted to tell you. It's
Thank
unbelievable.
You,
I just wanted to say, what you're seeing in America now, in my opinion, is just basic, you know, human nature. It's greed. It's where if I, you know, I want more, I want to succeed, and once I get more, I want even more. And if you look at how many years do we want to be at war? I mean, doesn't that look great for our country, going on 6 years at war? Like, we can't even figure it out.
Let me suggest, though, that, Bob, let me challenge your assertion that this is basic human nature. I believe that basic human nature is to look out for each other. Basic human nature is to form community. Basic human nature is to protect your family. Basic human nature is to say we're all in this together. This greed is good stuff. This Gordon Gekko stuff, this Reaganomics stuff, this robber baron stuff is, in my opinion, a form of mental illness. It's another variation on sociopathy.
I agree with you, but it comes from, I think, post 9/11. It's almost like a
no. It's always been with us. It's always been with us. I mean, you're right to the extent that it is a dimension of human nature, but it is not the dominant force in human nature. And that's what we see in, for example, the European countries that are doing so well, in Sweden and Denmark and Germany and France. And, you know, people, let's create a society where people feel safe, where people feel secure, where you can get a free college education, where, you know, life goes on. So, but your point about greed, you know, well said, Bob. Thanks a lot. Robert in California. Hey, Robert. Listening on Green 960.
Hello.
Hey, Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, I was just grabbing this book. Tom, I've been trying to get a hold of you for a while. You're hard to get a hold of, I might
well,
add.
Thank but, you for calling.
Brilliant, man. You are so brilliant, and you're really trying to help so much. But I have to add, in lieu of listening to your show and the our 960 you know, compatriots, that these several reads are just fantastic. I started with Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
John Perkins' book.
Naomi Wolf and the End of
Shock
America.
Naomi Wolf, yeah.
And then Naomi Klein's, which I'm halfway through now, which is a must read for everybody.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. She's both Naomi Wolf and Naomi Klein and John Perkins have all been on this program, and they're all brilliant books, absolutely.
To add to that, I wanted you to read Joseph P. Farrell. Have you heard of him?
I have not.
Joe P. Farrell deals with the title of the book is The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And if you really want to know the strategic reasons for the right wing doing what they're doing, everyone needs to read that book. And that's why Kennedy was disappeared and Martin King was disappeared. And, I mean, this is just incredible, an incredible read. And I just heard an interview with him the other night on George Norrie, first time.
Yeah.
Incredible read. But please, Tom, read this book. I actually hit you with a couple of emails.
I'll check it out.
Really,
the SS
Brotherhood. Your perspective on.
Okay, great, Robert. Thank you very much. I got it. I'll check that out. Richard in Fortuna, California. Hey, Richard, just a half a minute here before the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I had some questions. I thought in 1945 the U.S. government put a cap on profits per barrel of oil, and that
you know, there, during World War II there were caps. There were wage and price,
right.
There, you know, there were all kinds of price controls.
Did they lift that prior to that, or was that still in place when Bush took over?
Well, I think all that stuff went away at the end of World War II. I mean, the Truman Commission and all that stuff Franklin Roosevelt said nobody's going to make a dollar on this war, and Harry Truman, you know, went out and prosecuted companies that were war profiting and things. That all went away within a year or two of the end of World War II and the implementation of the Marshall Plan. Yeah, that was, you know, and to the best of my knowledge, we had this windfall profits tax for a while, and I think that was during the Carter administration, as I recall, on the oil industry. Maybe it went back to Nixon. I don't exactly remember, but we did have a windfall profits tax on oil for a while. And there are people who are calling for it to come back. And I think it's at least let's stop the subsidies of these guys. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
We'll be right back. 49 minutes past the hour. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, I wanted to get into some of the economic issues that are facing us right now. And I think it's so important because most people, I think, don't realize that this is what's really driving the whole train. The whole Republican agenda, and for to a large extent, the entire Democratic agenda, the history of this country is an economic history. It's all about the money. The Republicans are all about the money for the wealthy few, and the Democrats, by and large, are all about the money for everybody. And let's have a strong middle class. I mean, that's how it has shaken out for basically about 200 years. It hasn't always been the Republicans and Democrats, but shall we say the conservatives and the liberals. It basically, the conservative worldview has always been, let's have a very, very strong central plutocracy, aristocracy, whatever, you know, a meritocracy. Go back to John Adams and Alexander Hamilton's notion of how it should be, you know, for that matter, even Jefferson endorsed to a certain extent a meritocracy. And part of the reason why but he wanted it to be available to everybody. This is why he started the University of Virginia and said it's going to be free. Anybody can go who is capable of studying here can go for free. Because he didn't think that it should be a lineage of the wealthy. But in any case, at the front page of today's Financial Times, the headline, IMF puts cost of crisis at $1 trillion, $1,000 billion. And financial sector faces further write-downs. The estimate came as minutes revealed that the staff of the Federal Reserve and many of its policymakers believe the U.S. economy will contract the first half of this year. In other words, they're saying, hey, this is going to get worse. It's only not even half of it has worked itself out, and we're going to have a serious recession. Then the Bank of Japan comes along. Now, this is truly startling. This was, again, in today's Financial Times, Masaki Shirakawa. He's going to be confirmed, in all probability today he was confirmed, as the new governor of Japan's central bank. He's the equivalent of Ben Bernanke, the equivalent of Alan Greenspan. He says, the world is facing its most serious financial crisis since the 1930s. He says U.S. authorities may need to use public funds to bail out their banking system. That's our banking system. Mr. Shirakawa said the global credit crunch was even a risk for Japan's financial system. And then here's another piece from the Financial Times. IMF points to high cost of global credit crisis. And Krishna Gui, writing in Washington, if the International Monetary Fund is right, the credit crisis that began last year could turn out to be the most expensive financial crisis in history. This is like, you know, worse than the Japanese, whatever you call it, recession, long-term recession. Many Japanese would call it a depression. What's it been going on since the 1990s? Worse than the 1930s. Nearly half the ultimate losses will be taken by non-bank financial institutions, pension funds, insurance companies, government-sponsored enterprises, hedge funds. They said, moreover, the degree of leverage in the system has increased dramatically in recent years. In other words, because so much of this is borrowed money, it's going to be far worse. This is like what happened in 29. Everybody was borrowing money to buy stocks, to speculate in stocks. Now everybody was borrowing money to speculate in real estate. No. Yeah. The stress on the financial system is reflected in the high level of spreads in the interbank money market. In other words, what we're seeing here is that the system, the symptom of the crisis in the system is the difference in the spread in the amount of money that banks charge each other when they loan money, between that and the amount of money that central banks charge banks when they loan money to them. And typically they're about the same, but right now banks are charging a whole lot more money to other banks because they don't like the risk. And they wrap this article up by saying, since the crisis began, the proportion of the stress relating to the credit risk has steadily increased. Moreover, it has not fallen back significantly since the rescue of Bear Stearns. The risk of a systemically important bank failure has increased substantially. This is from today's Financial Times. This is not an op-ed. The risk of a systemically important bank failure has increased substantially, the International Monetary Fund estimates, as has the estimate of the number of institutions that would fail if one went into default because of the domino effect. Now, on top of that, you go over to the Wall Street Journal today. Small business optimism plunges. The National Federation of Independent Businesses says its index of small business optimism fell 3.3 points in March to the lowest reading since the monthly surveys began way back in 1986. That's when, you know, who knows what it might have been, lower or below before that. Maybe 1929. And this Greg Ipp wrote this brilliant piece in today's Wall Street Journal. He's one of their best financial reporters. About, you know, what's the Fed going to do? They've got this graph on there that shows all the treasuries that the Fed owns. It was 87% in July of 2007. And it's down to 53% now. They've sold off about a third of their treasuries, or auctioned them off, as a way of trying to deal with this problem. But they still have to keep reserves, right? They still have to have their asset reserves. It was $910 billion on July 18th. It's $919 billion now. So what are they doing? They're taking in riskier things. Repo loans, discount loans to dealers, term auction credit, discount loans to banks. Other Fed assets has grown from 10% to 13%. The bottom line here, the Fed, in order to try to, you know, keep all their fingers in the dike, is running out of fingers. As Greg notes, you know, British and Swiss banks are also contemplating contingency plans. The Fed, like any central bank, could print unlimited amounts of money, but that would push short-term interest rates lower than it believes would be wise. So what are they going to do? They're not sure. The issue is the Fed has sold or committed a lot of its treasury support to financial markets. Some worry that it will soon run out and there will be no more room to do anything. So what are they going to do? Well, they're talking about having the Treasury issue more debt and then take that money and put it on deposit at the Fed. It's like, hey, Ralph, loan me $100 so I can loan you $100. So we can tell everybody that between the two of us, we've got $200. This is a Ponzi scheme. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. So what happened yesterday when General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker testified before Congress? And perhaps a larger question, why do we have the guy on the ground talking about U.S. foreign policy rather than the people who are crafting U.S. foreign policy? You know, Secretary of State, for example, or the Mr. Gates, the head of the Department of Defense. Jed Babin is with us. Jed is the editor of Human Events, served as a deputy undersecretary of defense in President George Herbert Walker Bush's administration. He's the author of In the Words of Our Enemies, of Showdown, Why China Wants War with the United States, and Inside the Asylum, Why the UN and Old Europe Are Worse Than You Think, humanevents.com, the website. Jed, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Tom.
In your Human Events column at humanevents.com from day before yesterday, you started it out, your first sentence, the Democrats fear tomorrow. And then a little later on, you talked about how any changes that may happen, and General Petraeus suggested this pause in the drawdown of troops. I don't know if that's the change you were anticipating. Will probably help John McCain, and that the Democrats fear the political effect of any final Bush initiative on Iraq. What's your sense as a Republican, as a conservative, as somebody who supports this occupation and the surge of what happened yesterday?
Well, let me just take back a notch a little bit. I mean, I am certainly supportive of the surge. I was supportive of the war, but I do believe that things are not going in the right direction in Iraq, but that's not General Petraeus's fault. I mean, the interesting thing that came out yesterday was apparently somebody calmed Hillary Clinton down. The last time General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker testified back in September, she basically accused General Petraeus of being a liar. She said that his report would require a willful suspension of disbelief, which is calling the man a liar. So she toned it down a long way yesterday, and I don't think anybody really scored any political points. What happened was that the general, as he usually does, he always does, told it straight and basically said that our accomplishments in Iraq are tenuous and reversible, that things are going reasonably well as they're going. But the more interesting point he made today, I think in answer to a question by House Armed Services Committee Chairman Ike Skelton, that basically was putting him on the spot on that point on foreign policy. And he just said, hey, look, you know, I am not.
I'm just the guy who executes it. I know. But both he and Crocker refused to talk about what our long-term strategy is in Iraq. I mean, that really should be the issue, should it not?
Well, it should be, but that's not for these guys. You know, they don't make the policy. A military officer has to, and you know, this was drummed into me 4 decades ago when I was in Air Force ROTC, civilian control of the military above all considerations.
I understand, but shouldn't they, in the process of executing the policy, be able to at least point to it?
Well, they can point to it, and they did. You know, they're pointing to the fact that they're trying to implement the policy, but if you want to take up changes in the policy, you know, defects in the policy, of which there are many, you have to take it up with, as you said, Secretary Rice and Mr. Bush.
On BBC News yesterday, I saw a news report where they were in a neighborhood that the U.S. had bombed 3 or 4 days ago during the Shia uprising, as it were, in Baghdad.
Basra, yeah, okay.
No, this wasn't in Basra. This was in Baghdad. We apparently did some bombing in Baghdad as well. And you know, it was a couple of houses that got taken out. And there was this father, and his 3 children had died in the bombing. I mean, bombing is pretty indiscriminate. And he's got these pictures of these 3 little kids, and he's sobbing. There's blood on the ground. I mean, literally, you know, behind the camera shot, you can see the blood. We have these actions that you and the Bush administration have supported in invading this country and in occupying it so incompetently all these years have led to the death of so many human beings. When does it stop?
Well, first off, I take issue strenuously with your idea that this is indiscriminate bombing. It is anything but that. It stops when the President of the United States decides either that the policy which he has espoused, which I do not agree with, this whole nation-building nonsense is a neocon nightmare, when the President of the United States decides he wants to change the way he's dealing with it or when he leaves office. That's when it stops.
So how is the, again, you started your piece out saying that the Democrats are fearing tomorrow, but it seems to me that this neocon nightmare is creating more whiplash for the Republicans than for the Democrats.
Hardly. The Democrats are totally incompetent on this. They got elected to the majority in Congress in 2006 on the basis that they were going to stop the war. Well, they can't organize themselves to stop a company picnic. These guys are utterly incompetent. And I think that a fair look at the Congress's performance since 2006 shows that, quite frankly, their leadership is probably the worst leadership in the history of the Congress.
Well, you're not going to get a lot of disagreement with me on that. But are you suggesting that the Democrats should have stopped the war?
Well, I'm suggesting
that the occupation. I mean, you know, the war was won back, you know, when Bush declared that the war was over in May of 2003.
He didn't declare the war was over. Come on, let's at least get our facts straight.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
That sounds to me like a declaration of victory.
Well, you're wrong. Again, I mean, you've got to get your facts straight. That was a declaration of major combat operations against Saddam's regime, which was over, which Saddam's regime
We took
was
down their defeated. Government. We took down their army. We control their cities. We control their economic structure. What other definition of the end of a war do you need?
Well, an end of the war is when the enemy surrenders. The enemy never surrendered there. The enemy is not just the Saddam regime. The enemy was, and I wrote it at the time, if you want to take the trouble, you can look it up. I wrote in April of 2002, almost a year before the war started, that the president was getting it mixed up, that he was not defining the enemy clearly or correctly. And the enemy has always been the nations, plural, that sponsor terrorism. Unless and until those nations stop sponsoring terrorism, the war goes on.
So we need to be bombing Saudi Arabia?
I didn't say that. You're
well, Saudi Arabia is the largest. Is not Saudi Arabia the largest sponsor of terrorism in the world right now?
No, Iran is.
And historically,
Iran
they have,
is the largest sponsor.
Saudi Arabia, they run TV telethons for money for Hamas and Hezbollah, or for Hamas anyway. I mean, you've got.
I'm not saying they're not involved in it. You said who is the biggest? The biggest is Iran by far.
So we should be bombing Iran, in your opinion?
Well, I think we should do a lot more. I'm not saying we should bomb them, but I think we have to take and make sure all options are on the table. The idea that your guy, Barack Obambi, to go there and you know, look like a deer in the headlights and see if he can negotiate with them is ludicrous. You can't name any successful negotiation, not one, with that regime since it took power in 1979. Why do you think that negotiating with them now is going to work? It's facetious to even suggest it.
But what I would assert is that bombing them will not work. It will do the exact opposite. It will further polarize their people. You have a very, very large progressive movement within Iran. You have, prior to Bush's, you know, bellicosity and our participating in the region, you had a moderate who was elected to be president of Iran.
Prior to our participating in the region. I guess that goes
Let me say, prior to our bombing Iraq.
1947.
Well, you know, okay.
When FDR sat down with the then king of Saudi Arabia and arranged our involvement there.
Yeah, well, sure. We have had long-term problems in the region.
So it's all FDR's fault.
I wouldn't disagree with the suggestion that we shouldn't have, in the very beginning, started saying, "Okay, this oil that happens to be under your land, that's going to be our oil." No, But the point is that if Hezbollah and Hamas and organizations like this are able to get the people of the region to support them, and for that matter, Al Qaeda are able to get the people of the region to support them by building schools and building hospitals, and in the minds of the local people. Whether you and I agree with it or not, you know, I mean, we're looking at a larger stage, but the minds of the local people, they're helping out. I mean, they're doing the politics 101. Why don't we? Why instead are we bombing people? You can't shove democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun.
Well, that's what I've been saying since April of 2002. It is not our job to deal with establishing democracies anywhere. Our job as Americans.
Why should we be bombing Iran?
Well, we should be bombing Iran because Iran is bombing us. Iran is killing American soldiers with their explosively formed penetrators. They're arming, training, and funding Lebanese Hezbollah. They're training, arming, and funding these special groups that are attacking American soldiers. That's why. I'm not saying we should bomb them. You keep saying bomb, bomb, bomb.
Yeah, all righty.
You want to go sing with John McCain?
I guess so. Jed Babin, humanevents.com. Jed, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, my pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Apparently the name of the place is Afghanistan or Pakistan. Joe Biden talking to Ambassador Ryan Crocker yesterday before the United States Senate.
Mr. Ambassador, is Al-Qaeda a greater threat to U.S. interest in Iraq or in the Afghan-Pakistan border region?
Mr. Chairman, Al-Qaeda is a strategic threat to the United States wherever it is in my...
Where is most...
Got to keep that boogeyman going!
If you could take it out.
Okay, so then Joe Biden says, all right, if you guys really think that Al-Qaeda is the biggest threat to the United States, then where are they and where are we?
You had a choice. The Lord Almighty came down, sat in the middle of the table there and said, Mr. Ambassador, you can eliminate every Al-Qaeda source in Afghanistan and Pakistan or every Al-Qaeda personnel in Iraq. Which would you pick?
Well, given
now he starts to dance around this one.
Given the progress that has been made against Al Qaeda in Iraq, the significant decrease in its capabilities, the fact that it is solidly on the defensive and not in a position
Which would you pick, Mr. Ambassador?
I would therefore pick Al Qaeda in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border area.
That would be a smart choice.
Yeah. Assuming that that actually is the biggest enemy that we face. John in Scottsdale. Hey, John, thanks for listening on KPHX. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, thank you, Tom. I'm just kind of disgusted with the talking points of your last speaker. Totally disgusted.
They are hitting all the media, full court press today, right now.
Yeah, just talking points. Now, we invaded Iraq, so for him, that's suddenly a fight against terror. But we know, based on the record, that Al-Qaeda, in quote, the terrorist, weren't active in Iraq.
Right.
Then you have the suspension of reality bit, where we are bombing, or they are bombing us. I guess he's talking about 9/11, because I don't see Iraq or Iran or any of the other powers in that area, or nations in that area, having a viable air force to bomb us in the street type.
Well,
stuff.
this is their new pitch that they're bombing us with these IEDs.
When in fact
you
had him dead to rights, Tom, where we bomb them, and you have a father out there with his children in a photograph that any fool could see. But what they do is they want to shift their argument. They want to go to the war on terror when you got them beat in Iraq, or you point out the stupidity of Iraq. And then they want to go to Iran when you talk about the actual source of the terror, if there is terror, in Saudi Arabia. And they're just all over the place, and they want people to believe that they know what they're talking about. I just think it's absolutely outrageous. And that person's in our Congress. That kind of a muddled mind is operating the levers of our nation.
Yeah, well, Jed Babin is not in our Congress. He was the He was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense in George Herbert Walker Bush's administration.
Oh, excuse me.
He now publishes Human Events, which is one of the... thank you for a great show.
And I would hang up. Anyone that's muddled and that dislocated mentally really doesn't deserve radio time, in my humble opinion.
Well, I think it's important that they be challenged on the air. John, thank you for the call, but I really do think it's important that these folks be challenged. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make the point that the gentleman that you just had on previously, the guest, used one of the number one Republican strategies in interviews, where he said you would ask him, you know, when is the war over, basically, and he says, well, the generals can't decide that. It's decided by civilians. It always has been that way, and it's up to George Bush. Well, you ask George Bush, and he's going to say it's up to the generals. I'm not making a move without the generals. And they just talk in this vicious circle. They have not. No one has taken responsibility for anything they've
done.
Well,
and in the meantime, Blackwater and Halliburton, which has now moved to the Middle East, are making out like bandits, you know, and a bunch of other contractors and large Republican donors. And it's absolutely nuts. It's absolutely nuts.
Cracking the code is on the top of my list for my next purchase. I'm just wondering, do you cover this particular way of how they get their message out, where there is no blame? They keep shifting the blame to somebody else, and then
to some extent in cracking the code. Yes, to some extent I do. Yeah, Steve, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick, got a minute before the break? What's up?
How did he get away with saying that Iran was the biggest, you know,
funder of terrorists in the world? He simply asserted it. I mean, how can you respond to something like this? Like, yeah, you know, oh, show me some proof. Well, you know, they're behind these things. We know this.
I mean, in a year they would be saying Chavez. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
No, yeah, absolutely. Fill in the blank. It's after Nixon, when Nixon was president. Nixon came back from the Soviet Union from a meeting with Khrushchev, I think it was, and declared détente. That wonderful word Henry Kissinger came up with, and said the era of terror is over. That was his phrase. And the committee for the something defense. This committee was put together by Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. This was during the Nixon administration.
Why didn't the committee for the common defense say anything to him, though?
Right. Well, at a certain point, what can you say? It's like, okay, so you're asserting that you've got no proof. But the Committee for the Present Danger, that was what it was put together, and they came out and they said the Soviets have a submarine that is so secret that the CIA doesn't know about it. The CIA said there's no such submarine. They said, see, there was no such submarine.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
664-3223-2270. 34 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, teamsters.org, teamster.org. Hillary Clinton talking to Ambassador Ryan Crocker yesterday.
The administration has announced that it will negotiate an agreement with the government of Iraq by the end of July that would provide the legal authorities for U.S. troops to continue to conduct operations in Iraq. Let me ask you. Do you anticipate that the Iraqi government would submit such an agreement to the Iraqi parliament for ratification?
Okay, so in other words, is this thing that we are, apparently the Bush administration, the executive branch of our government is negotiating with another sovereign government. Is this a treaty? Is the other sovereign government going to submit it to their legislature? Is it a treaty? Because at the end of this year, the UN authority for the United States to be in Iraq, which they did after we invaded illegally, they retroactively gave us authority to be there. It expires at the end of this year. So is this a treaty, Mr. Crocker?
The Iraqi government has indicated it will bring the agreement to the Council of Representatives. At this point, it's not clear, at least to me, whether that will be for a formal vote or whether they will repeat the process they used in November with the Declaration of Principles, in which it was simply read to the members of the parliament.
See, the Constitution is quite explicit. The power to make treaties is with the United States Senate.
Does the administration plan to submit this agreement to our Congress?
Excuse me, to approve treaties.
At this point, Senator, we do not anticipate that the agreements will have within them any elements that would require the advice and consent procedure. We intend to negotiate this as an executive agreement.
So Bush is going to bind the next president. I mean, this is as crazy as it gets. And then you got these guys running around all over the media saying, well, you know, in Iran, that's who's killing our young men and women here in Iraq. It's Iran. So, therefore, we need to go bomb Iran. And if we weren't in Iraq in the first place, who would they be shooting at? Well, if they had jobs, they'd be going to work. I mean, the vast majority of these people who, in fact, I'd say virtually all of them, who are fighting against us are people who would, frankly, much rather be working, you know, building roads, building bridges, going to work every day. People would much rather have jobs than war. It's just, this is not rocket science. Mike in Scottsdale. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Your guest, Jeb Babin, also promulgated another talking point in his attempt to basically assassinate the Democratic Congress, and that was that he said the Democrats were elected to end the war and they failed miserably. Well, 2004 wasn't that far away, and I don't think there was consensus among Democrats that the war was needed to end or needed to end right away.
Well, he was talking about 2006, actually, and I think that there was a broad consensus then, and many people who were voting for Democrats believed that the Democrats would stop the war if they were elected.
I think many did. I also think that most of the people that let the Democrats come in were tired of the corruption, the lawlessness and the corruption of the Republicans, and it was a protest vote against them rather than a hope that the Democrats to come in and save the day. They never had the numbers to do that. Yeah. They didn't.
You know, I respectfully disagree with you, Mike. But here's the problem that Nancy Pelosi has. She has a 30-some-odd seat majority, but there are higher than that number. I think it's in the low 40. I think it's like 42 seats that are held by Democrats who are actually representing districts that traditionally have voted Republican. And
right.
So those Democrats, if they start behaving like progressives or if they start being aggressively anti-occupation, they could lose their seats. So while it looks like Pelosi has a majority in the House of Representatives, the reality is that for most issues, most of these progressive issues that are on your agenda and mine, she really doesn't have a majority. And so, you know, it's a cheap shot, I suppose, and I engaged in it when I was discussing this with Mr. Babin. You know, he said, you know, these people are Pelosi and Reid basically are incompetent leadership, and I said, you're not going to get an argument from me. The reason why I would say that the leadership has been relatively incompetent, although they have accomplished a lot of very good things, is that they have not been aggressive. They have not taken on the Republicans the way that the Republicans would be taking them on if the tables were turned. For
right.
example, wiretapping. You've got, you know, this FISA bill. You have a president who has confessed to committing a federal crime, the law of which specifies that any federal employee, which includes the president, who breaks this law, will go to jail for 2 years for every single violation. And this president has bragged of at least 15,000 violations of this. If the Republicans were in power and the Democrats have been caught with their hands in the cookie jar of wiretapping people illegally, I guarantee you on the floor of the House, you would have had some Republican, probably John Boehner or somebody, or Boehner, whatever it is, out there pounding their fists saying, I know that this president was listening into my conversations. He had to have been. We want to know, you know, and they would have turned it into something political because it may well have been. This is what Nixon did when he was illegally wiretapping. He was listening in on Democrats. We still don't know if that's not the case. Why have the Democrats not used this to go to the next step and make this, you know, political? And for example, that's where I'm concerned is that their messaging is way off base. Mike, I got to move along, but I appreciate your call. Thank you. Jeff in Orange County. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to, prompted by the announcement of the number 10 guy in Al-Qaeda being killed for the 47th time or
right.
whatever
yeah.
the deal is.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know that, you know, when all of this began prior to 9/11, we received videotapes that said, get your military bases off of our Holy Land or else. And then or else happened. Since that point in time, people have bought into the talking points that they hate us for our freedoms. And if that's the case, by the definition of terrorism, they're not terrorists. They're just murderers, actually, because
yeah.
they're not trying to advance a political agenda. They're trying to get us off our Holy Land. My question is, though, if they released a tape that said, we're watching what you're doing, and you're not holding your president accountable for the quote-unquote mistakes he continues to make over and over again, killing our citizens with these mistakes. These aren't little, small little things where somebody tripped. People are dying by the hundreds with these mistakes. Do you think we would even see a video? It would be published at all, or would the government here say, you know what, it needs to be held back. There's too many things. There could be a message.
No, here's how backwards it is. Bin Laden is loving what Bush
is
doing. He is loving it. What we are doing is we walked into the exact same trap the Soviets walked into in Afghanistan.
While Bin Laden's bragging about the fact that Reagan helped them do that.
That's right. And Bin Laden set that trap for the Soviets, and he closed it on them, and then he talked about how he was going to set that trap for us, and we walked right into it. You could argue that George W. Bush has done everything that Osama bin Laden wanted. Osama bin Laden said that he wanted the price of oil to be over $100 a barrel. It is. He said that he wanted U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia. We left last year. He said that he wanted the U.S. to be bled dry in an ongoing and protracted war in the Middle East. We are there. It's happening. You got Republican George Voinovich saying this is bankruptiness, and Osama bin Laden wanted to keep his freedom and you know, live a nice life. And he is, and he has.
What do you think would happen, though, if they released a video that said, if you don't hold your elected leaders accountable, we are going to hold the American people accountable?
See, that's what
we would ever even see that
no.
or hear about it.
No, but I don't think that they, you know, I mean,
I think that's where we're at.
Now, Bin Laden is loving the neocons. I mean, this is, you know, we are his best recruiting tool. And that's my point. Every time, like that father I saw on BBC night before last, or last night, you know, from the day before yesterday, every time we kill civilians, every time, for that matter, every time we kill people who consider themselves freedom fighters, who think that they are simply ejecting a foreign invader from their country, who have the same mindset that, frankly, George Washington had, many of these folks, in Iraq are simply nationalists. They're just people who last month or last year were car mechanics, or 5 years ago now, were car mechanics, and now they're saying, get the hell out of my country, I want my country back. And every time we kill them, we create more people who hate us, and it has nothing to do with our so-called freedoms.
We get one militant in a bombing raid, we kill 17 civilians. If you look at the average size of a family in Iraq, call it three people in the family, more likely five per family. If you kill 17, isn't that 17 times five surviving family members who are going to be quite upset with the United States?
Absolutely.
This is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is, and they are playing right into the hands of the people.
And I agree with you. I don't think George Bush has a conscience to know that this is either right or wrong.
No, it's incredibly profitable for him, and it's incredibly profitable for Bin Laden. Jeff, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. Karen in Sacramento. Karen, we just have a minute here before this break. What's up?
Let's remember Pat Tillman when we talk to these neocons. They can't swift boat Pat Tillman, can they?
Well, they tried. They tried his family. I mean, you know, it's when his family started raising questions, it was like, whoa, you know, there's somebody. I mean, they must be Democrats. You know, what's going on here? The whole whispering, the rumor campaign, and everything against the Tillman family. I mean, it's
horrible.
Yeah.
Well, and since the Fox News has been playing Jeremiah Wright, I've had two people on the roadway roll down their windows, almost crash into me with their car, and give me a thumbs down because I have an Obama sticker on the back of my car. So,
oh man,
join MoveOn.org and get on that petition against Jeremiah Wright, Fox.
There you go. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Karen. The Obama's pastor. Yeah, that's the endless loop, isn't it? 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. Our number, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for all information about the network.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman program.
Submit to you that this is the calm before the storm, that the storm is going to come probably in October. Here you had Martinez, Graham, Lieberman yesterday in the Senate when this discussion with Petraeus, all of them trying to essentially blame Iran for what's going on in Iraq. And, you know, the reality is that Iran is supporting all the Shia, a whole variety of them. And not necessarily against us. It's just, I mean, this is their neighbor. I mean, it's, anyhow, Ellen Ratner on the line with us, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen. What's
good
going
day.
On in the world?
Well, I'm actually at the House Republican Radio Row. They chose to do a radio row today. I tried to get somebody to get on the air with you, but so far nobody has the courage. But, you know, one of these days I'll succeed.
Okay. Well, we'll be doing the RNC together. You and I, I'll be at the Republican National Convention, so that should be entertaining.
Okay. One of the things before I get into the hearings, which I was at this morning, is that The Hill has a very interesting front page news report this morning saying that the FBI taped lawmaker calls with Rick Renzi, who, as you know, ran against my friend Ellen Simon and was indicted.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of this is, most people say, oh, good, Rick Renzi, you know, he's a whatever creep, he deserves what he gets. Well, that very well may be true. But the fact is, when you become the FBI and you're beginning to think about tapping wiretapping members of Congress's calls, which involved other members of Congress. And the question is, did they tape anything in his office? And
this
also,
this is unconstitutional. The Constitution specifically states that there is a separation between these three bodies
the
of government.
Well.
Right. Yeah, that the executive branch will not interfere with the legislative. I mean, this is what the Supreme Court just ruled in the Jefferson case, didn't they?
Exactly. And so now we're finding out that the FBI is just doing this kind of thing. And they said, well, other lawmakers, you know, were not involved in anything. But when you, I mean, what gives the FBI the right to tap these phones?
Right. The FBI being an extension of the executive branch of the FBI works for the president. And I guess the argument that would be made is that Congress's police powers are very limited. I mean, basically, it's the sergeant at arms. It's the Capitol Police. And so if members of Congress are committing crimes, how do you go after them?
Exactly. And so this is, I mean, it's a real concern. And it's a real concern, I mean, for instance, Congressman Ney. His assistant was persuaded by the Justice Department to try and take papers out of his office. That's probably illegal.
Right. Well, and if we want to go back, look at how J. Edgar Hoover was actually blackmailing members of Congress and several presidents because he had the goods on them because he had been listening in and whatnot. And he, in turn, was being blackmailed by Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante. And, you know, so to deny that there was any such thing as the mafia. And I frankly don't have the answer of if on the one hand, the executive branch, which is supposed to be running the law enforcement apparatus in the United States, abuses their power, as Nixon did, for example, big time. If they abuse their power by spying on members of Congress for political purposes, or as appears to have happened with the federal prosecutor down in Alabama with the case of Don Siegelman, if they're abusing their power, then what other police power can be brought to bear against corruption in the House of Representatives of the Senate?
Well, I mean, there is a sergeant of arms, and there is a way of actually going through the various. I mean, I remember my friend Joel Hefley was the head of the ethics committee.
Yeah, there's the ethics committee, and you can go after a member of Congress when Congress is out of session, right? I mean, they can go into their home district and follow them around, can they not legally? And that's not a violation.
I don't know, but I do know that you cannot take things when they're doing legal business.
Right. I think it's just like a member of Congress cannot make a fundraising phone call from inside their office. But if they walk out on the street in front of their office on public property, then they can make a fundraising phone call. Because in their office, they're working for Congress, and outside their office, they're on their own time.
Exactly.
I think
exactly.
The same way the FBI can listen in on their conversation while they're standing on the street, but it can't listen in on their conversation when they're in their office. That's my understanding.
As I understand it, though, and we just talked to a couple of lawyers up here on the Hill, that if they're doing congressional business, it may actually follow them on their cell phone. In other words, they may not be able to listen in on that.
The FBI may not. Yeah, interesting.
So, and to listen in to other members of Congress, I mean, who knows? That would be a giant fishing expedition.
Right, especially if those members of Congress happen to be discussing, for example, what are we going to do in these congressional hearings about the FBI and the federal prosecutors and the Don Siegelman case?
Exactly. Exactly. Or perhaps the prosecutor's issue.
Right. Right.
So I think that's one of the most disturbing things I've seen. Back to the hearings this morning, nothing really terribly new this morning. I'm not at the hearings this afternoon. One of our staffers is. But it was very sort of staid, not a lot of questions. Of course, there was some questions. Actually, Vic Snyder of Arkansas was one of the first people to say, well, okay, tell us exactly how about electricity, how about water, how about vaccines, what has been the progress on that? And neither Ambassador Crocker nor Petraeus had the full answer on that.
And these are the basic metrics of whether a society and a culture is
working. Is a failed society or not.
Right, a failed state, yeah.
And they also, John Spratt of South Carolina, Democrat, asked about the costs and what the cost might be for 2009. Mm-hmm. Couldn't really talk about that.
Yeah, and Boinovich talked about that yesterday. He pointed out it's bankrupting us.
The one thing that they did mention is that they are halfway through the reduction in the surge forces at this point.
But Petraeus is calling for a pause in that reduction, is he not? 45-day pause?
No. After they have reduced down to pre-surge levels, there will be a 45-day pause.
I see. In any further reductions.
That's right.
Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, you know everything. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to have you on. 57 minutes past the hour, Leo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, is now out on DVD. We will be talking to the producers right after this break, then back to your phone calls and the news of the day. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
A couple years back, two, 3 years, I'll have to do a reality check here with Lila and Nadia in just a second. I got a call, or we were contacted by some folks associated with Leonardo DiCaprio down in Hollywood, down in Los Angeles. Santa Monica, actually, as I recall. Saying that they were putting together a movie about the situation of the world, you know, the state of the world, what's going on and what can be done about it. And, you know, would I come down and be videotaped for this? It was a great honor, some extraordinary people. The movie opened in theater release last year. I was at a couple of the opening nights. It was just great. And it is now available on DVD. It's called The 11th Hour. Leonardo DiCaprio narrates it. The link to the movies site, warnerbrothers.com/11th hour, is there's a link to it right off our homepage at tomhartman.com, right at the top of the page. You can easily find it. And with us today are the directors of this documentary, The 11th Hour, Lila Connors-Peterson and Nadia Connors. Lila and Nadia, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, great to have you both with us.
Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. So, first of all, for our listeners who perhaps are not familiar with The 11th Hour, Nadia, why don't you give us your snapshot or your you know, elevator speech on what the movie is all about?
Well, I really like the way that you introduced it as a state of the world, because a lot of people think, oh, this is an environmental film, it's a global warming documentary. In fact, it is all of those things. But like you so eloquently put in the movie, which is really the turning point in the film, it's about how we're thinking. And so it's ultimately a film that positions the environmental problems that we see today as a product of a larger problem. And that problem is the way our civilization is constructed and the presumptions that civilization makes, that nature is there for free and that we're not being frugal anymore, and that these loops of connection, of feedback to our natural systems have been broken in a society that is heavily about consumption. We have a very short-term thought process. So, I mean, it deals with, obviously, it sounds like very big issues, but it is a sort of seamless story about humans' relationship to this planet.
Yeah, it's an absolutely remarkable movie. By the way, it's my BuzzFlash book of the month. It's a DVD now, but over at BuzzFlash.com, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much for doing that.
Get that over there. And people can support BuzzFlash as well by buying it through them. But
and you know, it's $5. It's a special price that they actually negotiated this so that more people can buy it and use it as a tool.
Yeah,
so.
$5. I mean, it's amazing. And for just an extraordinary movie. Lila, one of the, you know, even though I've written about this kind of stuff extensively, I've written books on it, I've written articles about it, I speak on it. The first time I saw the movie, I got an aha. There was this forehead slap for me, and that was, and I don't recall who makes the point in the movie, but the point was made that in all living systems, everything that produces waste, that waste is the food for something else. We exhale carbon dioxide and inhale oxygen. Trees inhale carbon dioxide and exhale oxygen, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, just as a simple example. And there's, in all of the world and in all of nature, there is this exquisite, continuous circle. And there is one giant exception to that right now.
Yes.
And that is. Yeah.
Humans, the industrial system.
And which is working. Tell us how we have broken away from.
Absolutely. I mean, basically the idea that everything's waste is someone else's food in nature is sort of understood a lot by people like William McDonough and John Todd and a lot of the biomimicry people, and William McDonough being an architect and a designer who is bringing those concepts into the built environment. But what's happened, and even humans lived that way to a certain degree a while back when we were less developed, but the industrial system has created, like Ray Anderson in the film says, you know, we're basically digging up the world and turning it into waste. And we're not learning how to reuse resources wisely or reuse the waste of our economic stream. So Bill McDonough talks about when he lived in Japan many decades ago, you could hear the sound of the ox carts bringing the food waste from Tokyo out into the fields, and that would go into the soil.
Right, it's compost.
And then it would come back in the form of food. Mm-hmm. And so even up until very recently, there were still what they call closed-loop cycles of resources, you know, where compost becomes food. And so we need to reincorporate those principles into the design of our lives, from everywhere from recycling at home all the way to, you know, industrial manufacturers that are now really learning to create zero-waste processes, where, for example, if you're a chair manufacturer, you make your chairs, and then maybe bring your chairs back when people are done with them, and a chair becomes a chair again.
Well,
or a chair part becomes something else. And so the waste stream of the industrial world needs to be reconsidered and reincorporated into other products, rather than going back to the mines and digging up more of the earth. As Ray also says, you know, there's more copper in landfills around the world than there are actually in the earth now.
Mm-hmm. Nadia, you wanted to hop in on that?
Well, yeah, I wanted to say that this whole concept of waste is actually relatively new, because for a very long time, human beings had such an intimate relationship with the source of their livelihoods that that idea, as I brought up earlier, frugality was something that was incredibly practical. And Richard Heinberg, who's in our film, says it's really about oil, which obviously, Tom, you're the one who inaugurates that concept into the movie about talking about ancient sunlight. But this idea that our society changed when we discovered oil, and that what oil did is really interesting, because a lot of people think about oil in terms of global warming. But what oil also does is it allows us to accelerate the process in which we dig up the earth and turn it into waste. So it's given us almost like we've kind of gotten on this high where we're not thinking clearly anymore because we can do things so fast.
It's leveraged us.
Yeah.
Nadia, one of the concepts that I think it was Kenny Acevedo brought into the movie was that the human footprint is pretty massive. In fact, I was debating Mark Morano of James Inhofe's office here last week, and I said, as far as I know, there is not a single biological system anywhere in the world that's not in decline right now. Can you name any? And he was like, no, I can't. But he didn't present himself as an expert on biological systems. So in a way, I guess it was, you know, not quite a fair question, but the fact is laid out in the movie that there are no systems that are not currently in decline. And then Kenny comes along and says, we could reduce the human footprint by over 90%.
Yes, which is an extraordinary, you know, it's an extraordinary fact, and obviously to us, or at least to me, in the making of this film, that was such a revelation, because you hear all of this doom and gloom even as you're watching the movie, and then you suddenly realize it is about a shift in thinking. If we start to look at the world and use what we have, whether it's solar power or, you know, we have incredible technologies that can allow us to lessen this footprint that we have, this very, very damaging footprint. And to me, it's really not about the silver bullet theory. You know, from what we discovered, it's not like, what's that one thing that's going to change
you know, do we stop driving cars? Do we stop using oil? Do we stop doing this one thing? Or do we make this one amazing new thing? It's really everything in our future, and that's what's so exciting, is about diversity. And that, you know, you can power everything in your life by in multiple ways. And this is, I think, the world, and this is what Paul Hawken says. It's so exciting to be alive at this point because we get to rethink everything that we do. And rather than wait around and look for that one thing, how can we, you know, use the wind, use sun, use, you know, all of these other different things right now. I mean, I was just reading today about the largest solar deal ever made is happening now here in California. So
yeah.
Quite exciting.
We're talking with Lila Connors-Peterson and Nadia Connors, the directors of the documentary The 11th Hour. We have just about a half a minute left. There is a community or a community has formed around this movie, Lila?
Yes, basically we've created something called 11thhouraction.com where people can go to our website and create a profile and declare the kind of green action you'd like to take or sustainability action, and you can find other people who are doing the same thing.
This is 11thhouraction.com.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yes. And it's going, actually, ever since the movie came out, it's been a very, very robust community. Now that the DVD is coming out just after one day, it's spiking. So it's a lot of people coming on and learning how to take action.
That's great.
Which is the whole point of the film.
Well, we have a link to the trailer and to the Warner Brothers site. We'll put a link to 11th Hour Action as well
on our
homepage. Lila Connors-Peterson and Nadia Connors, the directors of the new documentary by Leonardo DiCaprio, now available on DVD, The 11th Hour. It's our Buzz Flash Book of the Month. It's available in fine locations everywhere, bookstores, whatnot. Lila, Nadia, both of you, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And thanks for the great work you did in this movie. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tom Hartman, if you want to drop into our, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And strange stuff out there, I'm telling you. You got to check this out. Go to MikeHuckabee.com. And what you see is coming soon. 6 days, 0 hours, 38 minutes, 47 seconds. And that's it. So what's coming soon? From Mike Huckabee in 6 days. I don't know. Is it a TV show? Is it a radio show? Is it a bombing campaign in Iran? I don't know. But it's pretty strange. Also, another topic I just wanted to bring up and toss out here, and then we'll pick up your phone calls. And you know, we've got a lot of stuff on the table from all 3 hours of the program. But Barack Obama appears to be, did yesterday, make an argument at a fundraiser in Washington, D.C., at the National Museum of Women and the Arts. This was at a $2,300 person fundraiser. An argument against public financing of his campaign. And it may be actually a very cogent argument, because if John McCain opts out of public financing, if you take public financing, the problem is you also have to take the spending limits associated with it. And if Obama is the nominee, or for that matter, if Hillary Clinton is, frankly, because I think that there's so many Democrats out there who are so energized that whoever the Democratic nominee is, that there's just going to be a mind-boggling amount of money to be raised on the Internet. And this is the point that he makes, because when you're supporting, you know, the public financing comes from checking that little box off on your tax returns. Yes, send $3 or whatever, $5 to the public financing program. But he says, and this is a quote from Barack Obama, he says, "We have created a parallel public finance system where the American people decide if they want to support a campaign. They can get on the Internet and finance it. and they will have as much access and influence over the course and direction of our campaign as has traditionally been reserved for the wealthy and the powerful. Which takes us back, you know, in a very real way to George Bush and to the whole, you know, kind of Republicans, well, not kind of, I mean, you know, explicit, the whole Republican strategy of taking all the money. And, you know, Bush's comment that some call you the, you know, here we have the haves and the have mores, and some call you the elite, and I call you my base, as I, you know, this was Bush's, you know, famous quote. So is Barack Obama, by doing this, effectively short-circuiting that? And is that a good thing? Or should he stay with public financing? My personal opinion is that if he has to go outside of public financing, a system which is not as robust as it needs to be, if he has to go outside of public financing in order to defeat John McCain and have access to donors on the web, that's a fine thing from my point of view. I have no problem with that. And so, anyhow, your thoughts on it. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Jonathan in Manhattan. Hey, Jonathan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, man, long-time listener. I love your show. You're very informative and very intelligent. 30 seconds, if I can.
Sure.
You know, since 1500, you know this, you're a historian also. The Dutch, the French, the British, you know the history of Europe. Western civilization reached out to the rest of the world in such a manner, with a big stick, walking through all of these foreign lands, coming back in the 1900s, realizing imperialism and capitalism was draining on resources, blood was involved in it, all kinds of things. They began an isolationism of sort, the calm after the storm, and left the rest of the world in this quagmire of being taught how to be violent. Inventions like the Gatling gun, all these kinds of weapons that they used around the world. So it's like, my analogy really is, you get in a fight with somebody, you punch them in the face, you don't expect a punch back. There's a bit of karma that's coming back to this country, and the urgency of now was 2001. I'm six blocks from Ground Zero. I saw it that day. I thought that was the time to ask the questions why of Palestinians are angry, why in Afghanistan Osama was able to start those schools in the 90s, and why these things occurred. We're missing the why because we're so caught up in the moment, which is a very important moment now, but without history, we're doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
You know?
To quote George Santayana, as I recall. No, you're absolutely right. And that's that why question. And whenever anybody tried to ask that, and Jonathan, thank you for the call, whenever anybody tried to ask that after 9/11, you know, why? And there were some very thoughtful voices that brought this up. Bill Maher, in fact, was one of them, asking why. They got shouted down. They got called, you know, unpatriotic, undemocratic, you know, et cetera. What a tragedy. So, anyhow, Diane in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Diane, got about a half a minute here before this break at the bottom of the hour. What's up?
Hi. I'm just wondering, where's the public outrage, the media outrage, that Admiral Fallon is not being allowed to testify this week? In fact, he has a muzzle order on him. He can't testify at all to the public.
I'm sure he's not the only one. I mean, you have a large number of people within the military who are very, very concerned about these policies. And look at how many people have resigned from the military.
But he's the head of the Central Command.
Yeah, I know. He's the boss of the guy that we're talking to. You're absolutely right. And why is Condi Rice not sitting there testifying? And why is, for that matter, George Bush not sitting there testifying? There is precedent for the president testifying before Congress. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, our websites.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Okay, here's the big view, the overview. Throughout the day, we've been talking about, let's see, is the economy really going in the tank badly? I noticed gold has jumped like 30 bucks since I went on the air this morning. It's, in my opinion, because oil has gone up to $111, $112 a barrel. What does the market know that we don't know? Could it be something about war in Iran? Don't know. But, you know, something is going on out there. And might it have something to do with MikeHuckabee.com, where he says 6 days from now? Well, they're speculating about that over in the chat room. Fred says that's when they shut down the Internet, what MikeHuckabee.com has got set up. DeSaline in chat says Huckabee is hosting a squirrel cooking show. That makes sense. And, of course, Shep and a number of other folks in chat point out that 6 days and X hours from now is April 15th, tax day. And, of course, Huckabee has made his opposition to all things IRS at the corner of his campaign. So there's that. Is the Japanese central bank's equivalent of Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, is the new marshal or general or whatever of their central bank, is he right in suggesting that the United States might be facing another disaster, an economic disaster? And should we be concerned about and including bank failures? Is Barack Obama right in suggesting that public financing of campaigns is passé? I mean, this isn't his language, it's mine, but that's kind of yesterday. And today it's public financing of campaigns via the web with a $2,300 maximum cap for each individual. Or is George W. Bush right when he says,
"This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores." Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
Yeah. So, see, that's the kind of thinking that we want to see go away. Thank you very much. So, Mitch in Macon, Georgia. Hey, Mitch, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, I was listening to you talk about the constructive thinking. When we talk about our thoughts, most of the business leaders of the world today are thinking in modalities that we call reductionist thinking. Mm. And we're experts at it in America. We do really well. We take a thing and take it down to its finest point. And,
right. This goes all the way back to Aristotle and his atomistic theory and the idea that the entire universe is a machine and it can just be broken down into its component pieces and nothing's really alive. And yeah, got it.
Right. So that's a very good thinking process to develop. But what we also have to develop at the same time as that process is the ability to cross think, you know, like lateral thinking, like Edward de Bono talked about.
Right, holistic thinking. Thinking in terms of, well, literally the whole, and recognizing that everything is alive. I mean,
then we go to the next step in the discussion. There's two other aspects that we are dealing with in the educational curriculums right now in the field of holistic thinking. On the one hand, we have the First Nation or the Indigenous medicine wheel that talks about physical, mental, emotional, spiritual stuff.
Right.
And that's a good model, and I certainly use it myself and recommend it. But it doesn't deal with the situations we have today in terms of systems thinking. And the second step that you have to integrate over the first one of the medicine wheel is the notion of what I call the four E's: economics, energy, ethics, and health.
Yeah. Now your original point, if I got this right, Mitch, is that Barack Obama is a holistic thinker and that other candidates are not, presumably.
Exactly.
Okay.
Bang on.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. I think that frankly that's a lot of his appeal is that he always the way that I described is he always goes to the bigger picture. Somebody goes in and they say, well, you know, quack, 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 and he steps back and says, well, what's the bigger picture here? And which is something that I try to do on this program a lot, and I think it's really important. And your point, by the way, of reductionist thinking is a really vital one. If everything is a machine, then there's something that we're fundamentally missing. I can take a car apart, or at least back before they put computers in cars, you know, when I was a kid, I could take a car apart and have pieces all over the driveway and put it back together and turn the key and it would run. But if you take a cow apart and then you stitch it back together, it's not going to move. There's something fundamentally different between living systems and machines. And we have not, in our culture, in our society, and this is one of the issues that this movie, The 11th Hour with Leonardo DiCaprio, addresses, that we have not figured out. We haven't even recognized how screwed up our thinking is in regard to this. This just fundamental perspective. Glenn in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. Hey, you asked about Obama and the public financing situation. The first time I became aware of him saying that he would run on public financing was when Tim Russert asked him during one of the debates in Ohio or Texas. I can't remember which one. And I thought his answer back then was just like his answers have been all along. Very good. He's not answering the question until he needs to. But the fact that he put it out there yesterday, I'm in total agreement with it. I'm an independent voter. I never check off the box on tax returns to give money for that. This is the first time in my life, and I've voted since I was 18, that I've actually donated money to a campaign. And anybody who lives in the world now knows the internet is here to stay, and that's the way most people communicate, I guess, in regard. He already is receiving public financing. It's just coming via the internet.
Right.
When Russert asked him that question, that was my first thought. He already is publicly financed with, 70% of his donations or $50 or less?
Yeah, it's actually, I think it's more like more than 90% of his donations are less than $100 or something like that. But increasingly that is true of Hillary Clinton as well. Both of them are drawing heavily on the internet. It is not so true of John McCain. It was very true of Ron Paul, though.
More to the point then. The Republicans are going to come back at him and saying, oh, well, you said this, but you're doing this, so you're just, flip-flop or whatever term they want to use.
Right.
Actually, the way I see it is he is willing to adapt to, in a logistical sense, to level the playing field, which I believe is what he said during that debate also, is that if that arose, he would deal with it then because he wanted to make sure it was a level playing field when he was running against McCain.
Yeah, excellent point, Glenn. Excellent point and well made. Thank you very much. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Oh, yeah, I have to disagree with you, sort of, not to a great degree, but when you said the 2006 election was about ending the war, I don't recall any of the Democrats campaigning by saying they were going to end the war. A few of them did, but most of them probably weren't incumbents, and most probably didn't win. And I think some of the Democratic base thought they were voting to end the war, and the pundits and the media and whoever else, they spun it that way. But anyone who thought it was going to the war or occupation was going to end, say like 12, 18 months, just wasn't reality. I mean, Bush,
it would be really interesting to see a breakout of which candidates were taking what positions on the war, part of their campaign process for the 2006 election. And it would be also very interesting to see how the media was spinning this thing, to what extent this expectation, if it's a myth, as you're suggesting, or if there's some reality to it, as I was suggesting, that both the candidates and the voters were believing in the 2006 election when they moved in the direction of the Democrats that was going to bring this occupation of Iraq to a more rapid conclusion. It would be interesting to know, to what extent that was a construct of the media versus to what extent that was reality. And I frankly don't know a metric for that other than going back and looking at every single individual campaign and looking at the news coverage of every campaign and seeing to what extent it was true. But so, it may be that the reality probably is somewhere in between the two, Dan, but your point is well made and I appreciate it. Eli in Anaheim, California. Hey, Eli, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Long time listener, first time caller.
Well, thank you.
Why do we leave it up to the politicians whether we need to go to war or not? We have a
because that's their job.
No, but
we appoint them to. We appoint them essentially by electing them to act on our behalf in running this country. And one of the things that a country does is decide whether or not it's going to go to war.
Okay. How about the people who go to war? The soldiers who volunteer. And they should be the ones who need to vote whether war is needed or not. Otherwise,
we should be the ones who vote. No, the soldiers, and ask any soldier. Soldiers are very clear that their job is, to kill people and blow things up, and they're not outside of obvious things like the Nuremberg principles, obvious human rights violations. Their job is not to decide the morality of what they're doing. Their job is simply to do it.
The way it is now, politicians are asking our soldiers to go fight.
Yes.
Our soldiers should have a say whether this war is needed or not before
they do in the ballot box. And what we saw in the 2006 election was that in those few places where the military vote was actually released to the public, where it was made public, the military was voting overwhelmingly Democratic. That's what Martha Raddatz was reporting on CNN. I played the clip from it either yesterday or the day before yesterday, that when she went out and this was following a McCain speech to a bunch of GIs, and she went into the audience and just started asking them, who are you going to vote for? Who are you going to vote for? Who are you going to vote for? And over and over and over again, they were saying, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton. Why? Because I want the war to end. So that's where the vote takes place. And yes, the soldiers should vote, but they should vote for a politician. You can't have the soldiers running their own military policy, as it were. If you did, it would just be, frankly, a disaster. I mean, that's no way to run an army. As much as I am not an advocate of hierarchy and patriarchy in general, in some institutions, and particularly a military institution, it's really the only way that not necessarily patriarchy, but hierarchy, it's the way it has to run, because we, the people, collectively are giving them an assignment. And they have to do that assignment. So, you know, and so ultimately what it comes back to is us, we the people. Back to the tag, you're it, right? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Minutes before the hour. Well, is it possible?
Better take off your coat.
Is it possible that
real slow
making love?
Better take off your shoes.
Might be the most effective way to save the world's largest tropical rainforest. Yeah, The Guardian. According to the Brazilian government, which this week opened a $10 million condom factory deep in the Amazon jungle, it could be an effective weapon in the battle to silence the chainsaws of Amazonia. Yeah, just don't forget the condom. On Monday, government ministers gathered in the remote town of Zipuri to open a condom factory that will use latex manually extracted from the area's forest to make around 100 million condoms a year. This is going to keep the trees growing. It's going to keep the Amazon going. It's going to save the rainforest. Make love, not forest destruction. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Gary in Hollywood. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Oh, hi. You were talking about the London Guardian. What I came for in the first place, their headline today is IMF says U.S. Crisis is the largest financial shock since the Great Depression.
Right, yeah, that was, I pointed that out in the first hour of the program, that the International Monetary Fund has come out with this new study, I guess, or, you know, paper, basically saying that this is the worst disaster of the last 100 years.
Yeah, and it's
it hasn't even half played out yet.
Right, with a one in four chance for a full-blown global recession. Now, it seems to me, if we go down to the details, isn't the IMF run, or wasn't it anyway, by Richard Perle, who was also started the war?
No, you're thinking of the World Bank, and that was Paul Wolfowitz. But, you know, neocons are neocons, and world financial institutions are world financial institutions.
Yeah, really. You know, they all smell the same.
Yeah, it's an easy one to make.
And what they're talking, and this is really, and one more detail that's even more ironic. I picked up another piece in the LA Times, and every week they do a section on cars, and they're showing the new Jaguar, now owned by the Indian corporation Tata. They're paying Ford $2.5 billion to try and bail them out.
Wait a minute. Tata is the largest car manufacturer in India. That I know. I've driven in their cars.
It's the group. They just bought out a Jaguar and a Rover from Ford.
So the Indian company Tata is giving money to Ford to buy. Oh my god!
They just threw $2.3 billion to try and bail out Ford. How do you like that?
Amazing. Well, I'm not surprised. It's amazing. If you go to economyandcrisis.org, you get all the stuff. Yeah, I mean, this is the selling off of America. Thanks a lot, Gary, for the heads up on that. I'll have to check it out. Barbara in New Mexico, listening on KVOP. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hello, Tom, and thank you. Listen to you every day.
Well, thank you.
More and more, I'm reminded of this New World Order. I can see Bush saying this as if it were just yesterday, Bush Sr. And I'd like to hear your feedback. And the question of the day for all my community, everybody I run into, is who owns the Federal Reserve?
Well, actually, if you go down, I don't know the name of the local banks in your community, but when I lived in Vermont, in Montpelier, Vermont, the local bank was the Chittenden Bank, or at least the one that I banked with. The Chittenden Bank was a Federal Reserve Bank. It was part of the Fed. If I bought, and in fact, they actually had a special offering for people who were customers of the bank, and I could buy stock in that bank. If I bought stock in that bank owned stock in the First National or the First Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. The First Federal Reserve Bank of Boston is one of the, I think it's 10, maybe it's 12, banks whose combined stock adds up to the ownership of the Federal Reserve. So you could buy stock in the Federal Reserve if you bought stock in your local bank.
Well, that's the closest I've heard to getting at the what's behind. Well,
but the reality is that there are some very, very large stockholders of these very large banks, and they basically are the ones who own the stock in the Federal Reserve.
Well, did you see the documentary by Aaron Russo called America, Freedom, Fascism?
Yes. In fact, we had Aaron Russo on the program. He has since deceased, tragically. He's a good guy. There were some areas of that documentary that I disagreed with. I thought he'd kind of he bought into the conservative talking point that we have the taxes are not the cost of admission to civil society, that we shouldn't be paying taxes, that the IRS is illegal, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought that was a tragic digression from the other really important points that he was making in the movie about the loss of democracy and freedom in the United States.
Absolutely. Well, I found it alarming. So, thank you, my friend.
You're welcome.
Here in the middle of nowhere listening.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. Anthony in Seattle, we just have a minute here, Anthony,
okay,
before the show is up.
Okay, I've got to beg to differ with you. I'm sorry, but I have to bring up Lieutenant Aaron Wattata here in Seattle. He did not go to the war in Iraq. He said he would fight in Afghanistan, but he refused to go to Iraq, and he did it because the war in Iraq is illegal. So when say that the soldiers cannot decide which wars they want to fight, I'm sorry, I beg to differ with you. They did it back in Vietnam, and it just,
and they were prosecuted then, and Wattata was prosecuted. Now, I think that Wattata actually makes an excellent point that what he's being asked to do, and I put this caveat in my original comment, that setting aside, outside of the Nuremberg principles, in other words, if you're being asked to commit a war crime, then you appropriately should say, no, I will not do that. And that's what Wattata has done, and I salute him for that because I believe that the Iraq war is a war crime. But beyond that, the broad principle is that soldiers don't make the decisions about, what they're doing. Those are decisions that are made by civilians. We want civilian control of the military. Tomorrow, Madeleine Kuhnen, three-time governor of Vermont, U.S. Secretary of Education, U.S. Ambassador to Switzerland, about how women can win and lead. And Jim Hightower is going to drop by. His new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.